I would say sometimes people enjoy starting with a point and shoot first. I mean, they may be shooting on manual on their digital camera now, but you know, for someone to pick up a film camera for the first time, an unknown film emulsion, you know, unknown results on working with a new lab, not really having a lot of background in scanning and that kind of thing. I think just keep it simple. And a lot of times point and shoots can do a great job. So, you know, to take one kind of complexity out of the equation and just keep it simple with automatic exposure, automatic flash, I think that that would help film photographers get started.
Welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast, brought to you by CloudSpot. Each week on the show, we interview the world's most interesting photographers to find out what it really takes to capture beautiful images and compelling stories so that you can start to do the same. Welcome back, photo friends. Today, we have a great interview. Film photographer and owner of the Boutique Film Lab, Ryan Tolbert. Now, on top of shooting film for years, the Boutique Film Lab develops and scans just an awe-inspiring amount of film today, which we get into. And I know that I've shared this before, but I started my photography journey on film with my dad's old Pentax K1000 and, you know, whatever film I could find from the store that was, you know, on sale. I didn't have any money. And there's just something about getting those, you know, those 36 prints back that is it's infectious. And it's so unfortunate that digital photography stole that from us. But that being said, film is kind of in the middle of this resurgence, trying to figure out, you know, where it's going to fit within the world of photography. And that means that we can still have that feeling of awe and wonder and, you know, oh, did the photo come out or not? And that's thanks to people like Ryan and the business Boutique Film Lab. So I know many of you have never shot film, or maybe if you have, it's been a long time. So today I asked Ryan to break down a full analog workflow for beginners. So if you've only shot digital, if you're just getting into this, no worries. This is going to be the perfect resource for you. We cover everything from, you know, picking out your first film camera, what films to use, how you can get creative in development, and of course, how to shoot film as well. So tons in this one, especially if you are new to film. So with that, let's go ahead and get on into today's interview with Ryan Tolbert. Ryan, I want to know, when did you know that photography was going to play an important role in your life?
Well, I think I first got the bug in college, right? I ended up taking a black and white darkroom class there and started learning about analog photography. This was 1998, 99, somewhere around there. And, you know, at that time, digital was very much in its infancy, not really kind of full mainstream for consumers yet even. But film was still in its peak, right? Because it peaked in 2001, I think, was the film sales was the highest year for film. So, at that time, I really enjoyed the process of developing film and making prints in the darkroom, right? And I think that's where a lot of people kind of find their love for photography, is when they can actually see that all the way through end to end, you know, in analog state. And you know, a lot of people find solace in the darkroom because it's oftentimes you're alone, or it's quiet place. It's just you and the red light. And, you know, especially pre-smartphone era, pre-social media and that kind of thing, it's just one of those places where you could go to kind of get away from everything and just really focus on making some art and producing something. And you have something tangible. And that's the real beauty of the darkroom for me, was just, you know, walking away with a print and saying, you know, I made this, you know, and not only did I shoot and compose this, you know, nice photograph, but I developed it and I also printed it, and here it is, right? So that, for me, I think that's where that started. And, you know, I was in school studying for something completely different. I was looking to get into the audio industry. You know, being in Nashville and, you know, being around music, I really had a love for music. Still do. You know, a career in that can be difficult. So, you know, even though I was studying for audio recording, I ended up taking photography classes and really just fell in love. But that's where it all began. That's kind of the roots. And then I kind of took a break after school on photography and didn't really shoot for myself personally or do anything until digital kind of improved a bit and bought my first digital camera in the early 2000s. And then it was just a hobby for a while until I got into full, you know, wedding photographer mode after that.
So I want to know, I'm always interested in that decision to change kind of career paths, right? Because I'm similar to you where I went to school for cinematography, decided that I wanted to pursue photography professionally. You thought for a long time, like audio is the way that I want to go. I love this. What was it about photography? Like, what was it about that thing that made you think this is the path that I actually want to take?
Well, you know, I think it's just, it's similar to audio in that, you know, I wanted that to be my creative outlet. Right. And so, you know, audio for me was about, you know, producing music, creating, releasing that, inner kind of, artistic side. And, you know, when I saw that a long-term future in audio and in the music industry was probably not going to be the direction I was going to go, I felt like photography could be something that could take that place and could be my creative outlet. And my wife at the time was had a side hustle as a wedding planner. And so she was around weddings a lot. And so when I took up photography and or got back into it, rather, then I decided, well, wedding photography, you know, is where I'm going to focus because that's something that's easily accessible to me and something that's kind of, you know, on my mind. And so that's where I started. And, you know, I didn't necessarily want to do studio photography or do strictly just portraits. Right. So I thought weddings would be great because, you know, you have the people aspect and you're more, and I always considered myself more of a documentarian. And so I think that's why it led me to that, is that I get to still interact with people. I'll still get to take some portraits, but I got a lot of kind of, you know, documentary that I can do and just kind of be that fly on the wall to tell a story and, you know, and let it play out in photographs that way. So that's where that happened.
Yeah, I resonate with that a lot. I love that ability to be able to shoot just so many different things at a wedding and not necessarily, you know, focusing on just one thing. Like, I only do portraits or mm-hmm. I only do, you know, commercial work or whatever it is. So I too like that. But I want to know now is that you bought that digital camera. You're like, I'm going to go shoot some weddings. But today you're in a very different spot
right.
where oh, yeah. you're focused a lot on film. And, you know, you started the boutique film lab. So I want to know, like, where did that transition happen? How did that all occur?
Well, so started shooting weddings around 2012. And, you know, that was fine for a while, shooting all digital and just kind of learning. I had a lot of good mentors at the time and just kind of, you know, really honing my skills and just getting more and more experience you know, running a photography business and being a photographer. But, you know, after a while, I wanted something a little bit different. And I think probably around 2013, well, between 2012 and 2014, I would say maybe, you know, I started to see a lot more buzz on social media about film, started seeing a lot of film posts. And, you know, Nashville community had actually a growing film community, and we had some Facebook groups and had a lot of interactions, meetups and things. And so started doing that as more of a hobby, right? With shooting weddings digitally for clients, all client work was digital, but kind of shooting film for myself as a hobby, and just got more and more involved in film and really learning about film cameras and film stocks. And, you know, I would send my film out to a lab here and there, but just in an effort to save money, I wanted to try to see what I could do on my own as much as possible. So I sort of learned about developing and processing my own film, learned about scanning, you know, bought some scanners, that kind of thing. And so that's how that transition happened, is I got into film as a hobby, you know, started shooting it for myself, really enjoyed it. Didn't think it was something that would ever work out for my clientele. Probably because I'm bad at marketing myself and couldn't find the right clientele, right, that really wanted 100% film. But anyways, we can talk more about that, is, you know, shooting hybrid and shooting, you know, marketing it for clients. But at least for me, it was something that I just enjoyed doing. And, you know, I would shoot a roll or two here and there at a wedding, just at my own cost. The more I got into that, I was like, man, I really would love to shoot, you know, entire weddings on film, but I just didn't know if that was feasible, just, you know, due to the cost, due to the pressure, due to everything. Right. So, I kind of always kept it more as a hobby, but more as I got into it deeper and deeper, bought more film cameras, bought some more scanners, some more equipment, started developing more and more. It's just one of those things that kind of turned into a bit of a side gig, you know, to actually run a lab, because, you know, I had a couple of clients just via word of mouth that were like, hey, you know, you can develop film, you can scan some film, you know, here's a few rolls, and let's see what you can do, kind of thing. And it just very much snowballed from there.
Yeah, because today you're no longer just a guy who kind of develops his own film every once in a while and kind of just scans his own film with a random film scanner. Today it's a bona fide business. So tell me where you're at today.
Yeah. So, I mean, today, we've come a long way from where we were, for sure. But, just like you, I used to be a one man show. It just used to be me. Today we're, you know, BFL has three employees plus myself, and, we process, you know, C41 film. We have several machines for that. We process black and white. We do E6, which has been growing a bit. And we're one of the few labs out there that does ECN2 film as well. So motion picture film that has rim jet layer on it. Similar to CineStill film for people that have bought some CineStill film, but they strip the rim jet layer off at the factory, so that can be processed on any C41 line. But yeah, that's where we're at today. And, you know, we started out, in infancy, you know, a good week for us would be, you know, 30, 40 rolls of film. Right. In a week, maybe that would be a lot. Right. But now we do more than that, you know, in just a few hours. Right. So, I mean,
wow.
Yeah. So, you know, we probably average, and this January through, you know, March or so is probably a slower time of year for us. But yeah, we're doing 1,200, 1,400 rolls a month or so.
Oh my goodness. Are you ready to transform your love for photography into profit? Imagine capturing beautiful moments while bringing in a little extra money for your family each month. Sound too good to be true? With CloudSpot, it's not just a dream. Designed by photographers for photographers, CloudSpot simplifies your business. Effortlessly organize shoots, send professional contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and enjoy faster payment payouts with the lowest fees in the industry, including PayPal. Forget lost emails and messy spreadsheets. CloudSpot offers a streamlined workflow, letting you focus on the moment. And here is the clincher. Grab your free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com and you'll get access to my personal wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires. So don't let uncertainty hold you back. Embrace the future of photography business management with CloudSpot Studio. Sign up at deliverphotos.com today and transform your passion into profit. That is a lot of film. Well, then I'm excited because you're clearly the guy to talk to about this, because today I've been getting questions from listeners kind of about film photography and wondering just like how to get started. And I realized that I don't really think that there's a good beginner analog workflow out there, like from the first time that you think about shooting film to like getting that first rollback. So that I kind of want to walk through all those steps with you today and see how that goes. So I guess my first question here is, you know, when it comes to that analog workflow, let's imagine that, you know, most of the listeners who are going to be getting into film are those who maybe they've been shooting for a year or two. Like they already kind of understand how photography works. They understand the basics. But now they're thinking about shooting film. Where should they even start?
Well, that's a great question.
That's a very big question, but I'm hoping that you can kind of dissect that.
You know, and it can be daunting because, you know, people see a lot of great film photographs on social media and they're like, you know, I I want that. I want to create something like that. I like that look. It's very interesting. How do I get started? And there's a million different paths that you can go down. But you know, for someone that's, you know, it's got a little bit of a background in photography, learning some basics of shots, some, you know, with digital photography equipment, and a little bit accustomed to that workflow, you know, making the transition can be a smoother. And I think the way to get started is, obviously, you know, first you need to find a camera. You need to find a film camera, and there's a bunch of different options out there, just like there is in the digital world. But, you know, I tell people to go check their local thrift stores. You know, sometimes you can find some decent deals out there, some gems even, really, if you go check your local thrift store, Goodwill, what have you. But then there's also tons of places for resale, places like KEH out of Atlanta. That's always a big one. That's where I've sourced a lot of my used gear back when I was getting stuff together. So I really like those guys. Of course, B&H and Adorama both have a used department worth checking out there as well. So yeah, I mean, you know, finding used gear, because let's be honest, I mean, there's not many new film cameras being made. It's very, very few. Actually, manufacturers still make new film cameras, and there's no reason to spend that kind of money either, right? So, but, you know, I would say sometimes people enjoy starting with a point and shoot first, just to take the, I mean, they may be shooting on manual on their digital camera now, and that's great. And I, you know, I certainly recommend that in a lot of situations. But, you know, for someone to pick up a film camera for the first time, an unknown film emulsion, you know, unknown results on working with a new lab, not really having a lot of background in scanning and that kind of thing, I think just keep it simple. And a lot of times point and shoots can do a great job, because there were a lot of great point and shoot cameras made back in the heyday of film. So, you know, to take one kind of complexity out of the equation and just keep it simple with automatic exposure, automatic flash, I think that that would help film photographers get started. So nothing wrong with a great little, you know, point and shoot from Olympus or something like the X-A2. I love that thing. I've got one, works great. I've had a few Canons that are okay. What else have I got that I really like point and shoot wise? I'm trying to think. Oh man, I used to have an Olympus Stylus Epic. I really, really loved. It got waterlogged on a canoe trip, and
oh no,
yeah, I got the roll out of it and got some pictures, but yeah, it's apparently not waterproof, even in a Ziploc bag, right? But those are some great ones. I mean, Contax makes some great, like the T2 and some others, but they're a little spendy. But some great point and shoots. The Nikon One Touch is also great. There's a whole list of point and shoots that are ideal for getting started. And you know, they're great little pocket sized travel cameras, great to take on a camping trip or outdoors or to a wedding, or even a disposable camera. I mean, honestly, you know, we see a lot of clients that start, you know, from the ground and just go out and buy a disposable. And that can take some pressure off there too, just to see what you get, you know. And some people really purposely want the look of the disposable camera, right? It's got a cheap plastic lens, so it has a really unique look, real soft edges. You got that built-in flash. It's just kind of bang on full, you know, full flash right there. And you get a lot of fall off in the background in a real dark kind of cavernous place. And some people just enjoy that, you know, mm-hmm. And that's a look. That's something you can't get with any other camera.
Right.
You know, any other camera, you can try and emulate it with film presets. You can do all this, but it's not a disposable camera. It's mm-hmm. not shot on film. And so that is why people seek that out. And, you know, you would ask yourself, you know, in 2022 with the fantastic cameras that we have on the latest iPhones or Android phones or mirrorless cameras out there, DSLRs with great lenses, all that, you can take stellar photographs, great bokeh, sharpness, great color, all of this kind of stuff. But sometimes that's not what people are seeking, right? And so there's a market for something else. And disposable cameras sometimes fit the bill for that.
Hey, Raymond here, and we're going to get back to today's show in just a moment. But let me ask you, do you feel like your photos have become a bit stale recently? Do you feel like if maybe you were shooting more, your photos would be better, but you're not sure what to shoot? Well, don't let your photography grow old and stale. Kickstart your creativity by trying just one of the 46 creative photo ideas in my free ebook that you can download right now over at creativeimageideas.com and bring some spice back into your images. Or, I mean, you could just continue to let your camera collect dust. I mean, the choice is yours. But deep down, I think that you know the answer. So again, download your free copy of my free ebook, 46 Creative Photo Ideas, over at creativeimageideas.com. That's creativeimageideas.com. Now, let's get back to today's interview. You know what I love? It seems like beginners who are very focused on gear are always excited, like, oh, one day I'm going to upgrade to full frame. You know, I'm gonna start shooting full frame. It's like you can shoot full frame for $11 if you go buy yourself a nice disposable camera, and that's exactly what you're going to get. You can do
it.
It's not very expensive to get into this. And I love how you you talked about the point and shoot there, because I guess even when kind of coming up with some basic questions for this interview, I was thinking more along the lines of an SLR, you know, the traditional interchangeable lens camera. But I think you're absolutely right. You know, if you're just getting started, like, try to remove as much human error as possible. And if you just stick with a point and shoot camera, you can get real good. But if we are going to consider doing the SLRs, I don't think I've shot with many point and shoots except for maybe disposable cameras. So coming from SLRs, let's think about these cameras, because most of them, as you said, not many new film cameras are being made today, which means that most of them are 30 plus years old, right?
Sure. Yeah.
What can we do to ensure that, you know, we're buying a solid camera and not just a hunk of plastic that's going to eat our entire first roll of film?
Well, I mean, if you buy it from a reputable place like KEH, they are all fully tested and come with a money back guarantee and all that too. So that's another good reason to buy from a trusted source. But there's also some great finds out there on eBay and just from, you know, Facebook Marketplace. But that's all buyer beware stuff, right? So you would have to kind of make sure you fully test it and vet that situation. But and I didn't mean to rule out the SLR. I think that's a fantastic way to start as well. And, you know, I started with a Pentax K1000. That's just the classic SLR out there.
It's back there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just classic SLR that I think a lot of people have, or that they can get passed down from their, dad or their grandfather, grandmother, whatever. And so, you know, if that's available to you, use that. You can also find some great SLRs out there at, every now and then, maybe at some thrift stores, but also there's plenty online as well. There's a whole slew of those out there. You just have to maybe piece together, the body and the lens separately. They're not always available as a kit, I suppose, but yeah, as far as checking it out, I mean, you know, you need to check out the battery compartment. A lot of times those will corrode because, you know, like you said, 30 plus years. A lot of times they'll have an old battery in there that would corrode and that acid would leak out. So you may have to clean out that battery compartment, which on a fully manual camera is really only going to affect the meter. So, you know, potentially it could work even with a corroded battery compartment, but it'd be ideal if you could have some kind of metering there. Just because I know, well, I don't want to assume, but I would just think that a lot of people will be more comfortable with in-camera metering versus a handheld incident meter. But if you can get a hold of an incident meter, buy yourself one from Sekonic or others, that's absolutely highly recommended. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Canon 8E1, a Pentax K1000, any of the Nikon manual models, the FM, the F3, or it could go up to like an F100. That's my personal favorite, just because then you'll have some aperture priority and some great metering modes there if you need it. But and then, you know, Canon's got some SLRs. I'm a Nikon man, so I don't always keep track of their stuff. But I mean, There's a lot of great SLR bodies out there and a lot of great lenses. I think that's the beauty of film photography, is that, you know, the film history those cameras have been around a lot longer, and a lot of those manual lenses, you actually have a very large selection. So that's the beauty there, is you've got a lot of great glass to shoot through. And I, you know, starting out building a starter kit, you know, you may just want to look for a 50 prime or a 35 prime, but yeah, there was some great lenses produced for a lot of those bodies. And that's always a great way to start. You know, no need to overcomplicate that either. A single SLR and one lens can do wonders, really.
I love it. I totally agree. So we got a camera. Let's say that, you know, I went ahead and picked up a Pentax K1000, got the 50 millimeter F2 on there, whole thing, about $100. Now we got the camera. Now we got to talk about film. What films would you recommend if somebody brand new to film photography came up and said, you know, where do I start? What's that first roll of film that you recommend to them?
So, great question. And yeah, I've got some absolute great recommendations for that. But the full disclosure, in the state we're in right now in 2022, the real answer is it's complicated. And that's because there's because of the pandemic, because of the supply chain shortage, there is a global shortage of film, especially 35 millimeter right now. So you may find that's a little bit more difficult to get than it has been in the last couple of years. But that aside, my probably number one absolute favorite recommended beginner film would be Kodak Gold 200. It's just a great film. A little bit of warmth to it, but great color saturation, not overly saturated. You know, we see a lot of Fuji Superior 400 come through the lab, and that can be a great film as well, or even the Kodak Ultramax 400. And this is just my personal preference, my personal taste, but those are a little bit oversaturated in the reds and the magentas. Some people like that look. If that's for you, that's great. But I think the Gold 200 is a little bit more neutral on that end. And it's just a really nice film. Even though it is a consumer film, I would absolutely not hesitate to shoot that for clients, for portrait work or anything else. But yeah, if you need a 400 speed film, nothing wrong with Fuji Superior 400 or Kodak Ultramax 400. I think Gold 200 being my top recommendation. Kodak Color Plus is also another 200 speed film that's really, really nice if you can get it. It's also kind of rare as hen's teeth right now. But, you know, for professional films from Kodak, I guess Kodak Portra 400 would be the go-to, right? It's a very neutral 400 speed film, very neutral on skin tones, very middle of the road. I mean, there's not much to say about Portra 400 other than it is just meant to be, you know, not to add much characteristic to anything. You know, it's not overly saturated like Ektar 100, and it's not, it doesn't have those kind of special greens like the Portra 800 does. It's not quite as moody as the Portra 160. So it's just one of those just straight up great films for, you know, like the name, you know, the name Portra comes from portraiture, right? So it's meant to be a portrait film, meant to be neutral in tone. And that's also a great one to start with. But it is a pro film, so it has a little bit more latitude for underexposure if you go that direction. But it is also going to cost a bit more, right? The reason I like Gold 200 is it's priced well. It comes in 24 exposure. It also comes in 36. Portra only comes in 36 exposure. So you've got a bit of choice there on the Gold, and that's why I really like it, to be honest. So it's kind of my number one recommendation for someone getting started.
Awesome. And I bet you'd be able to find this at the Boutique Fine Film Lab as well, right?
Yes, we do carry that when it's available, but it has been on back order for some time, and we're trying to get more stock on that. But yeah, the distributors have been out of Gold, so it is becoming harder to find. But it is something that we stock when we can get it, for sure.
What about black and white film? That's something that I think when people think film photography, oftentimes they associate that with black and white. So when it comes to black and white film, do you have a recommendation there?
Hey, Raymond here, and I know that diving into the world of editing can feel like navigating a maze, especially if you're just starting out. So that's why I created our exclusive collection of 52 Lightroom presets, absolutely free. While presets can dramatically enhance your photos, they're not a one-click solution. They're a starting point for your creativity and an opportunity to learn and grow in your editing skills. These presets work seamlessly with all versions of Lightroom, whether you're on a computer or using Lightroom Mobile. And they're designed to simplify your editing process, adding that professional touch to your photos while giving you the flexibility to fine-tune them to your taste. So if you're ready to take your photos to the next level, head over to freephotographypresets.com right now and get editing today.
I do, yeah. You know, if we're going Kodak, Kodak Tri-X 400 is just it's classic. It's classic grain. And it's a medium contrast. It's still a decent speed at 400, but has a lot of latitude. I really regularly shoot Tri-X at 1600 ISO and push it two stops in development. And that just gives it this really punchy contrast. Great for street photography, great for photojournalism work. Makes it a little bit grittier with the grain. But it just it kind of unleashes the beauty of that film, and it really is just a classic film that I just enjoy the look of. If you're going with Ilford, which I really love Ilford, the black and white is all they do, and they're a great company, and they offer a variety of different stocks. But their competitor to that, I guess, would be Ilford HP5, which is also a 400 speed film, very similar in grain. Again, I mean, they're kind of head-to-head competitors. So Ilford HP5 and Kodak Tri-X 400, also, medium contrast and definitely have a similar type of look.
Mm-hmm. So if you're on the fence, buy both.
Yeah. If you're on the fence, buy both.
See what you like.
And just see, I mean, some people may not even be able to tell much of a difference there, but there are some subtle differences. You know, every manufacturer has their own kind of tone curves and own sensitivity there. Yeah. So definitely worth checking out. If you want something completely different on the black and white spectrum, you could look for a T-grain film, and that would be something like a Delta 3200 from Ilford, or any of the Deltas are all T-grain films. And from Kodak, it would be T-Max, right? So they make that in a 400, well, a 100, 400, and a 3200 as well, mm-hmm. which they just brought back a few years ago. But that 3200 is something special. It really is a great film, good for low light. And that grain is just has a characteristic that's just timeless, It can make some beautiful photographs, beautiful portraits. Works great at weddings because it just adds to that kind of ethereal feel and just gives it a very nice look. Especially in medium format, in 120, it's just a beautiful, it really shines. Nothing wrong with it in 35, it's just that grain is definitely a little bit more pronounced and kind of more in your face. But, in 120, it smooths out a bit and it just becomes a really, really nice look.
Perfect. So I agree. I remember my first roll still of T-Max 3200, and I shot it like broad daylight. And those photos, they're still some of my favorite photos that I've ever taken. And in fact, I think I'll post some of those photos in the show notes if I can still find them. 2008, 2009. Anyway, okay. So we got our camera. We got our Pentax K1000. I'm gonna load it up with some Tri-X here, or I'm sorry, some. No, we'll stick with the gold 200, right? I'm gonna load it up with that. Is there anything that I need to know before I go out shooting to be able to capture the best photos that we can?
Yeah, you absolutely need to make some decisions, right? Unlike digital photography, you're a little bit locked into certain parameters there. So, if you decide to saddle up with gold 200, you're stuck at 200 ISO, and that's not something that you can really change. And so that's something that you have to get used to in the analog world, is that for that roll of 24 exposure or 36 exposure film, you're shooting with that same parameter in the entire roll. And so, we enjoy the creature comfort in the digital world of being able to change that ISO, that sensitivity, as our conditions change. But with film, you have to be a little bit more intentional And you have to know that you need to create all of those at that same sensitivity rating, so at that same ISO. So that's one thing that's different. So you just need to plan and know what you're going to be shooting for, make sure you have the right light for it. So 200 speed film works great outdoors, can work great indoors with enough window light, or it could work great with flash, but probably not good for dim, indoor lighting. So, you just need to know your environment, what you're shooting. So that's preparation, right? Just make sure you're definitely prepared for the shoot and knowing that, going into it. So I think I recommend for most beginners starting with film, that first roll, I would shoot the entire roll outdoors, just so you have enough available light there. So
that's a good tip right there. That's a good tip. Yes. I know a lot of people are going to want to take photos of the kids inside, of their pets,
right?
Of all these things. Yeah. Being outdoors, that's a big one just for the amount of light.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. Go ahead.
No, I just get really excited. I would love to hear what you were going to say there.
Well, and I was also going to say, you have to remember that most film, not all, but most film is daylight balanced as well. So shooting outdoors and under the natural light is going to be the best fit for color balance on that. Nothing wrong with shooting indoors, but a lot of us indoors still have tungsten bulbs or even tungsten colored LED lights, whatever they may be, but there's still that warmer color temperature. So just know that on film, that is going to turn quite orangey yellow. And so that, they're not balanced for tungsten. So, unless you specifically get a tungsten film. So that's the other thing you're stuck with is in the digital world, we enjoy the creature comfort of being able to adjust the white balance to our conditions. But we don't necessarily have that luxury with film, where we're kind of stuck with whatever the film gives us. So we just need to know that we're shooting with a daylight balanced film. We're shooting at ISO 200 for the entire roll. So the only other things that we have control over would be our aperture and our shutter speed, right? That's really all that we can change there. So just need to know that you're shooting in those conditions.
Now, I remember when I was in film school, our cinematography teacher would always teach us to err on the side of overexposing our film rather than underexposing, which is the exact opposite for digital. But I know, or I guess I'm assuming that there's been advancements in technology, maybe through scanning and editing over the past 12, 14 years. Is that still good practice to do?
100% good practice. So film has a ton of latitude, especially colored negative film. Now let's just make sure we're clarifying.
Gold 200.
Well, but specifically color negative film versus say a positive film like E6 or black and white film even is a little different. But color negative film, such as gold 200, it absolutely loves overexposure. And that you're going to err on the side of overexposure for that every time. So there have been tests done to where, film has been shot at normal box speed. It's been overexposed one stop, two stops, three stops, all the way up to maybe six, seven stops. And that way you can kind of see the difference. The results are pretty eye-opening once you see that, but you can see how much latitude film has for overexposure versus, say, underexposure, because there's also been, tests done for one stop under, two stops under, three stops under, and you see that it falls apart pretty quickly. So, the 100% error on the side of overexposure. Even for people that don't have a light meter or a working light meter, you can use the Sunny 16 rule, and that's always a good one to live by, even in the digital world, right? The Sunny 16 works for film if you don't have anything else to go by, that'll usually get you pretty close, or at least where you need to be. So we see a lot of film that is underexposed, and a lot of times, especially with a consumer film stock, is that those shadows, just that detail is harder to recover for anything that's underexposed. Two-thirds of a stop or more, I would say. Sometimes they just get really muddy, really cloudy, and you do have more latitude on a professional film stock such as Kodak Portra or Fuji 400H, something like that. And that's why they're called professional stocks, right? They have more sensitivity to underexposure if you err that way. But the consumer stocks, they fall apart pretty quick. Those shadows get really nasty, and when you're trying to open them up digitally, you just see a lot of artifacts there and a lot of, kind of muddiness. So You know, a lot of times it's absolutely best to just go, you know, if you think you're going to underexpose, just open up another stop or whatever to compensate for that. And that's absolutely the best way to go. And like you said, that is completely different than what you would do in the digital world, because those highlights clip pretty easily going that way. So you're going to err on the side of underexposure, because they have an amazing ability to bring up, you know, shadow detail from something underexposed.
Right, right.
But yeah, it's definitely the opposite with film for sure.
Okay, so now that we've got a camera, we got our film, we went out, we shot a roll, we made sure that we were outside the whole time, right? Just sure. Made sure that we had a good white balance. We overexposed it by about a stop, possibly more. Now we have our finished roll, right? And I remember growing up, we would just take our roll or disposable camera right to Costco. We'd write our name on the bag, and that'd be it, done. And then we just, you know, pick it up about an hour later. You know, with professional labs like the Boutique Film Lab, we got a few more options for development and scanning. Sure. Can you walk me through what some of those options are when we're getting our film developed?
Absolutely. Yeah. So these days you do have a little bit more options than you did, you know, dropping it off at a 1 hour photo. So, you know, we can offer a traditional package in that, you know, you drop off the film and you can get a set of 4x6 prints with that. And, you know, for a lot of people, that's what they choose, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's great. It's a great way to view that film and, you know, put those in frames, you know, put them in a photo album, whatever you're going to do. I mean, that may be looked at these days as a bit of the old school kind of way, but that there is still a market for that. And there are still people that want that. So, yeah, you can absolutely get a set of prints with that and nothing else. You know, just get the film developed. You'll get the negatives back cut into strips of four and a little sleeve and away you go. But your other options are, you know, we can take that and run that through a lab scanner and we can provide you them with, you know, digital scans of that. So those are JPEG or TIFF files of those images from that roll. So at that point, you have a digital file that you can further edit if you need to do any post-processing on there, or you can, you know, just post that straight away to social media, share that online, what have you. So, and we do that in several different sizes, right? So we offer different resolutions of those scans depending on their end use. So depending on how they're going to be displayed, we offer three different sizes for that. We call it normal, large, and extra large. So those are our three sizes, you know, various pixels for those. But it really just depends on how they're going to be displayed and if they might be printed at some point later, right? Because, you know, the larger resolution scans are suitable for larger printing. And, you know, we've seen some fantastic photographs, even from 35 millimeter film. We've seen some 30-inch, 40-inch prints being made that are just beautiful. Wow. So it's definitely possible, but yeah, you need more resolution to make those, right? To get close to that 300 DPI or so number. But yeah, from there, you know, we can offer a set of scans. We can offer scans and prints, you know, 4x6, 5x7, 8x10, whatever it is that they need from that. But those are the options. And of course, you know, most younger generation probably just want scans. And, you know, want to be able to download those when they're done and post those to social media or, you know, share them in an online album or something like that, back them up in the cloud. But there are a lot of people that still want a set of prints just because that feels tangible and that makes the whole process, you know, enjoyable. Real. Just to be able to flip through, you know, photographs. Right. And so it's, or just to give away, you know, maybe they get a couple copies or whatever, but it's just nice to be able to hand someone a printed photo because, you know, I think it's printing, you know, prints have seemed to be something that we just don't do as much as we used to since we're not forced to do that, right? And back in the heyday of film, I mean, you really had no choice. You drop it off with a 1 hour photo, the product you were going to get back was a set of prints. I mean, that was just the end product, but we've got more choices these days. And so we got more choices to share those and more ways to do that. So I think sometimes prints just get forgot about sometimes, but that is the really the grand way of presenting something to someone. And it makes it more special when you hand someone printed versus just emailing them or texting a photo, right?
I agree. Totally agree with you. I want to go over something real quick because I'm sure that some people who are listening are maybe at a slightly more advanced stage. And earlier you had mentioned that you will take out, I believe you said Tri-X, shoot at 1600 and then push it two stops.
Yep.
Could you kind of talk about what pushing is and what that is for the developing process?
Yeah, absolutely. So, there's a lot of confusion around this. We get questions around this kind of stuff all the time, whether, you know, pushing and pulling both. But effectively, pushing would mean that you're purposely underexposing your film. So in the case of Tri-X, it's a 400 speed film natively. So in the case of Tri-X, if we were to underexpose it two stops purposefully, right? So that would mean going from 400 to 800 to 1600, right? So every time you go up a stop, you're doubling that number. So 1600 ISO, shooting it purposely two stops underexposed. And someone might ask, why would you do that? Two stops underexposed, you know, but you're doing this intentionally for a couple of reasons. Number one, you want the higher speed. Maybe you have lower light conditions. You need 1600 ISO to make a usable shutter speed, right? Because sometimes in a dim situation, 400 ISO just may not give you that. You may be down to a 15th of a second or a 30th of a second. You're unsure about motion blur. So if you can go up two stops in ISO, then you can maybe shoot it around, you know, 60th of a second or 125th. And so that helps for low light situations. But number two, pushing film just changes the look, right? And so it's going to inherently give you more contrast. It's going to give a very punchy image. So, you know, this is a black and white film. And if you shoot Tri-X 400 at 1600 and have it push two stops, it is going to be purely black and white, right? There's not going to be as much kind of middle tones. And some people just really like that in your face kind of black and white image. And, you know, I think we've all seen those. And especially, you know, for people that do photojournalism or street photography and just want that kind of gritty, punchy look, it's an artistic choice. So that's what it's for. And that's why people shoot it that way. You know, even in broad daylight, you know, on a sunny day, I might shoot Tri-X 1600, you know, especially if you've got a camera that can go up to a 4,000th of a second or 8,000th of a second shutter speed, you're able to slow that shutter down enough and still shoot at a wider aperture if you want. So, you know, you don't always have to shoot it at F8 or something, right? If you've got enough shutter speed there, but yeah, on a bright day, you do have to be a little careful, I suppose. But anyways, so we're pushing that roll to 1600, right? So we're two stops underexposed. So somehow we have to compensate for that. We have to make up for that two stops of underexposure. So that's where you have to intentionally tell the lab that you shot this at 1600 and you need it pushed two stops, for example. And so there is a preset time for, depending on the developer that the lab is using for that black and white film, there's a preset time that needs to be in the developer for 400 ISO, right, for the box speed. But if it was shot two stops underexposed, then they need to develop that for longer to make up for that underexposure, right? So that's where kind of the word push comes into play, is that we're pushing that development time, means we're extending it, right? So push means to extend, right, in that case. So maybe it was normally a, you know, 6 minute development time at box speed. So now we're going to increase that, 15 to 20% per stop or something like that. It depends on the film, depends on the developer. There's a lot of variables there, but that's for the lab, sure, to figure out the time. But maybe now we go from a 6 minute development time to, you know, maybe a 7.5 minute develop time or something like that. So the lab will develop it for longer. The longer the film stays in the developer, the more those shadows develop, right? Highlights develop first. And so if you took it out of the developer at 6 minutes, you're going to end up with probably some reasonable highlights, but you're going to have very underdeveloped and muddy shadows. So that extra development time, spending that extra 20% per stop in the developer, is going to allow those shadows to kind of bring up closer to a medium density, something that you have usable, and it should be able to bring some detail out of that in the scanner. So that's just extra compensation for the different speed rating that you did on that. And again, an artistic choice in some cases, but some cases maybe a choice out of necessity because You know, I was expecting a certain light level, but we just didn't have it. It was a cloudy day. It was dim indoor lighting. And so we had no choice but to go to 1600, and that's that, right?
Sure. Then I think that makes sense. And I really appreciate you kind of breaking down exactly what it is, because I know that, you know, when I first learned about the idea of pushing and pulling film, I got confused. So trying to figure out how to make it work, I think you really have to test it out and you really have to see it. I mean, because it really does, as you said, it alters the look of a film in a good way, of course. I mean, I guess depending on what it is that you're going for. But it's one of those things that, you know, one thing that I love about film photography is that it's real. Like, light enters a camera and then, like, alters chemicals on, you know, a piece of plastic, essentially. And mm-hmm. that piece of plastic can never be changed into anything else. And, like, that really happened. Like, it saved forever. And then when you take that into the development process, you can still alter that process to still be able to create an image that you're going for and create something, again, I guess real is the only word that I can really think of here. And it's just so much fun. It's just so much fun. So again, thank you for breaking that down for me. But now that we have our camera, we have our film, we went out and we shot it, we developed it. Next two questions about how long is the turnaround time from the time that we send in our film to the time that we get scans back? And then when we do get those scans back, are they ready to be shared online, or do they still require a little bit of editing on our part?
Okay, yeah, great question. So typical turnaround time for most orders is about 4 to 5 business days. It can be a day or two longer if the order also has a mixture of other films. Like if it's not just all color film, if it's a mix of black and white, maybe some E6 slide film or some ECN2 film, that might add a couple of days. But typically 4 to 5 business days would be our normal turnaround time. There's always those projects that demand expediency and that kind of thing. So we do offer rush options as well. So if you need a 1 day or a 2 day rush, we do have that available. For an additional fee, but typically 4 to 5 business days is the turnaround time to get those back. And we offer a couple of different service levels, right? So you mentioned kind of editing or any post-processing. So we offer a basic scan and we offer a premium scan. And the basic scans are all corrected in the scanner. So we color correct each frame. For, you know, mostly a neutral kind of color tone. And, you know, according to the client's preferences, if they specify they like warmer tones or cooler tones, you know, there's that option available that they can choose when placing the order. So we'll try to work to that aesthetic. But for the most part, we're just trying to get a good kind of middle tone out of that and neutralize any color cast that kind of come up. And then we'll correct density as well, right? So if we feel like there's some highlights that we need to try and recover some detail from, or if there's some shadows that need to be lifted up, we'll do that as well. But those are very rough kind of coarse corrections. And those are all done in the scanner software, as we're scanning each frame. So we get it close there, right? We get it as close as we can in the scanner, and that outputs a file. And for a basic scan, that's where we would stop, right? So that gets uploaded and sent to the client as that is, and with the understanding that those probably need some more tweaking to look their absolute best, right? I mean, let's be honest, every image could use some help to look 100% print ready.
Yes.
And so, with a basic scan, you're gonna get something that is a very good starting point, and it is something that probably could, or you could spend a little bit of time on each image with some tone curves, with some additional fine-tuned color correction, color grading tools on it, cropping every now and then, just because, you know, within 35, well, not just 35, with medium format film too, you know, sometimes the scanners might have the frame alignment slightly off. You'll get a slight little black sliver, a little black frame edge on the end. So with a basic scan, we don't do any cropping on that. So you might need to, you know, use a little cropping to crop that piece out, for example. But yeah, we're going to give you as good of a starting point as we can out of the gate with a basic scan. A premium scan, we will do those same color corrections in the scanner and get it as good of a neutral starting point as we can. And then we will do some additional post-processing on that. So using several tools that we have. We'll do further, tone curve adjustments, contrast adjustments, cropping, additional color grading on that to make it look 100% print ready. Sometimes there are retouching, even light, very light retouching. Like there may be some additional spots or something on each frame that might need, it's analog. So, things happen, right? Yeah. Images are just not perfect sometimes. And so, with a premium scan, we'll even use a cloning tool if as needed, cropping, those kind of things. So we'll spend some time on each frame by frame to make those what we deem to be 100% print ready. And so, depending on your workflow and your level of comfort, the basic scan, it would be ideal for a photographer that already has a good digital workflow down and wants to take control of that editing process themselves. But a premium scan would be something for a photographer that may be shooting for a client or maybe don't have the tools or the knowledge themselves to do that further post-processing. So they want something delivered to them right out of the gate that's just ready to give to a client or if it's for themselves, ready to post online and ready to go. So that's why we offer those two different levels of service there. And that's specifically for C41 film. In the black and white realm, we don't offer a basic versus premium. It's all kind of a premium scan. And the reason for that is that black and white film does not, the scanner software does not remove dust automatically like it does with color film. So we have to spot each frame anyways. So we take care of some cropping. We take care of some tone curves as we go through those as well. So that's already a premium scan. And so is E6 and ECN2 just due to the nature of those as well. But yeah, for color, you can choose a basic or a premium scan.
I did not know that about black and white scans with them not being able to automatically remove the dust. So that's interesting.
And the reason that is there's some people may have heard this term or know about it, but there's a technology developed by Kodak back in the day called Digital Ice, and it's mm-hmm. built into a lot of flatbed scanners. Epson uses it, others, but that technology was a Kodak technology, and it's a very advanced technology for when it was around. But I'll keep it short. I mean, I'm a technology geek, and I love to look into things real deep like that. But essentially, digital ice is a way to figure out where the dust spots are and clone them out. And the way it does that is it uses infrared, right? So it does a quick infrared scan before it actually does the fine scan. And infrared light, if there's a dust particle on the film, infrared light cannot pass through, right? So it does a quick scan of the film. And wherever the light could not pass through on the other end, it was not received, it marks that as a potential dust spot. And then it uses a cloning technology to clone that out and puts a little healing brush on it and does it all automatically in the software. And so color film, for the most part, comes out 99% dust-free. Because in the analog world, I mean, dust is the enemy. It's inevitable. It's going to be on every film. It just happens. And we use air purifiers and, we try to keep the room as clean as possible. And we try to keep the film as clean as possible. We wipe it down before we scan it. We use an anti-static brush. We use an anti-static cloth. We use all the air compressor to blow out the scanner. We try and eliminate dust whenever and wherever we can at the source, but, sometimes things squeak through. And so digital ice takes care of that for us on color scans, but on black and white, it's there, and there's just no way of getting around it. But and for people that want to know why digital ice does not work with black and white is because black and white film has a lot of retained silver after development, right? Almost all the silver is gone on color film after it's been bleached and fixed. But black and white inherently always has some residual silver there. And that residual silver on the film emulsion shows up. The light cannot pass through that, so it shows up as a defect. So if you try to scan black and white film with the digital ice technology, you'll end up with a really weird artifact of like weird cloning spots just all over your film. And it just will look pretty gnarly. So, it basically, if you're telling the film scanner software that you're scanning a roll of black and white, it turns off the digital ice. So if you're wondering why black and white film, a lot of times costs more to get scanned at a lab, that's why, because they have to spend time cloning dust. There are some labs that offer straight black and white scans with no dust correction. It's not something we do just because that's, you know, to us, that's not a final product. We don't want to deliver something that that's not kind of ready to go. So we make sure it's all cloned out. But that's why the price is also more. That and the development. And a lot of people don't understand that either, because a lot of people develop black and white film at home themselves. It's very easy to do, much easier than color, and cheap and all of that. And they're like, why would I pay more at a lab for black and white when it's something I can do easily myself at home? And you can, right? But on a commercial level, black and white's harder to do because there's not as many black and white developing machines to make it automated. They're much more rare. And that's why 1 hour photos never did black and white, right? You think about 1 hour photos, they were all C41. That's all they ever did was color film. Black and white, number one, I mean, consumers just didn't shoot black and white film, so there was not much of a market for it on the consumer end. It's also the lack of equipment, right? It's harder to develop that at a commercial level. Sure, it's easy to do one or two rolls at a time in your kitchen sink, in a Patterson tank or something. It's dead easy to do, but on a commercial level, when you're trying to do hundreds or thousands of rolls a month, it's much, much harder. So that's why some labs, even some labs that are still, you know, quote unquote film labs, they may still only offer C41. If they do black and white, they farm it out to a house somewhere else. So that's all the reasons why. Yeah. So I mean, you can get a roll of color film developed cheaper and faster than you can with black and white. So the turnaround time's a little bit longer. We only run black and white maybe 2 to 3 times a week as we get enough in. And color we do almost every day, right? So that's just, it's the 80-20 rule. You know, it's just the way it goes.
The 80-20 rule, that's right.
Yeah.
Ryan, before I let you go, I want to know, is there anything that maybe I didn't ask you today that you want to make sure that new photographers know or understand about shooting their first roll of film?
Yeah, you know, I think there's probably a lot of people that want to shoot film, but just maybe just anxious and just not, you know, they feel like it may be permanent, maybe something they could mess up or whatever. But just don't be afraid to try, right? I mean, that my advice is to, you know, and even if you go out and fail at it, I mean, you've still learned something, right? You still know what to change for next time, and you've still, you can walk away with some experience there. Well, I mean, we've all messed up rolls of film. I've done it myself. You know, from time to time, we see things like loading errors where a roll will come back blank, no exposures, you know, and it probably just didn't run through the camera. You know, 35 millimeter film, it's interesting that it's Kodak created all these other formats aside from 35 to try and simplify the film process all the way up until the end with APS film, right? With Advantix, Kodak Advantix and so forth. They were trying to simplify that because they also saw some issues, especially with 35 millimeter, right? I mean, if you don't stretch that film all the way over the take up spool as you're loading it, and it doesn't get firmly attached to those little, to the divots on the take up spool and right into those sprocket holes, sometimes that'll slip and that take up spool will just wind and that film will never advance to the camera. So you'll end up with a blank roll, or you'll end up with one 36 frame multiple exposure, right? It'll just sit there and slip on that one frame and it just exposes over and over and over again.
That's
right?
Gotta be cool.
I mean, those can turn out pretty cool, but by the time you've done it 24 or 36 times, it's pretty much just a blown out image, right?
Of course.
But yeah, I mean, there's going to be things that happen. There's going to be kind of, there's also going to be happy accidents too, right? Light leaks and things like that. Sometimes it look cool. Just don't be afraid to try and experiment. I mean, that's the beauty of analog, is that it is such a perfectly imperfect image. And it's something that is so unique and has its own little fingerprint. It's worth trying. And so, you know, it's just one of those things. Just hop in there and do it. And you know, don't shy away from it because, well, I don't know how to expose this correctly or whatever. You know, again, the point and shoot can take a lot of that out of it with automatic exposure and so forth. But I really urge people to jump in and try something new, you know, and just make 2022 to be a year of exploration and kind of finding new things. But yeah, analog photography, I mean, I never would have thought, if you would have asked me, you know, even 6-7 years ago, if I would have thought that film would have been where it's at today, But to be able to run a business and to be able to see film growing, new film emulsions coming online, that kind of thing, I never would have thought we'd be at that point, but here we are. And it's a fantastic world out there.
Ryan, I don't think that I could have ended it any better than with that sentiment right there of just go out and just try something new. So before I let you go, can you let listeners know where they can find out more about the Film Lab and you online?
Yeah, absolutely. So, we can find us all over the socials at Boutique Film Lab and Instagram, Facebook. You can find us on our website at boutiquefilmlab.com. You can place an order there. We have online ordering and we accept film from all over. So, you can mail it in. We're primarily a mail-in film lab and we're happy to start a relationship and communicate with our clients, and really favorite part of my day a lot of times is just picking up the phone from a prospective client and they're like, I want to send you guys some film. How do I get started? Where do I go? And then, I'm always happy to carry that conversation. So I love talking with film photographers. I think it's definitely a highlight of my day when I get to meet somebody new and just really get to build a relationship, make a connection. So we're excited to work with everyone.
Perfect. Well, Ryan, thank you again for coming on the podcast and sharing everything that you did, obviously about how to get started in film photography. I know, as you said, it's not always the easiest thing for new photographers to do. There is this air of scariness to it, but I think that you broke it down in a way that makes a lot of sense, and I'm excited to shoot some film and send it your way as well. So again, Ryan, thank you so much for chatting today. I look forward to keeping up with you and everything that you got going on here in the future.
My pleasure. Great talking with you as well.
This was so cool. My biggest takeaway from this interview with Ryan is that, film, it is fun. It is fun. And it doesn't have to be expensive. We don't have to go all out. We don't have to buy that, $3,000 Leica M6. We can start smaller, And the thing is that, today I primarily shoot, weddings. And I think when I put the camera up to my eye, I kind of get into this headspace of, oh, okay, time to perform. Let's find the best light. Let's find an interesting composition, and take yourself out of what's happening to wait and capture that best photo. But sometimes I don't want to be in that headspace. I just want to hang out with family and friends and not go full pro photo Ray taking photos. I just want to hang out and take some snapshots. And film is just a really, really fun way to do that. So if you have any film that's just sitting in an old closet and you want to get developed, or if you want to get into start shooting film, highly encourage you to do so. Take the information that Ryan shared in this episode and then go check out the Boutique Film Lab when it comes time to develop and scan your photos. They do a great job. Side note, I've now had probably close to a dozen rolls of film developed by the Boutique Film Lab, and they just do a way better job than I ever did when I was developing my own film, and they always take care of the film every single time. Now, before we take off, I do want to give a huge shout out to Kane for leaving the Beginner Photography Podcast a 5-star review. This is so cool. Kane says, I listen to the podcast every day, catching up on old episodes, listening to new ones, and repeating some that stand out to me personally. You always learn something new. Do yourself a favor. Go grab some headphones, a camera, walking shoes, and go on a journey. Kane, man, thank you so much for your review. That is so cool. I cannot tell you how happy it makes me that, you're not only listening to the current episodes, but you're actively trying to learn as much as you can by going back and listening to older episodes, as I know that they are still full of great photography knowledge and insight. So you're getting some great information there. Now, if you enjoy the podcast as much as Kane does, please consider leaving the podcast a rating if you listen in Spotify, or a review if you listen in Apple Podcasts. It really does help the show. Well, that is it for this week. Remember, the more that you get out and shoot today, the better you will be tomorrow. Talk soon.
Thank you for listening to the Beginner Photography Podcast. If you enjoy the show, consider leaving a review in iTunes. Keep shooting, and we'll see you next week.